Attention, attention, this is History Lost in Time.
And welcome to episode 30 of the History Lost in Time podcast. This time I'll talk about another basic document of communism. And apologies again, I am still suffering from the aftermath of a tooth operation, so should I talk a bit slurry, it's because of that.
The topic of this episode.
In episode 9, I talked about the Communist Manifesto of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. The basis was the book they both published in the 19th century. This time I will talk about a book that was published almost at the same time. The Principles of Communism by Friedrich Engels, originally published in 1847, even before the Communist Manifesto.
Political agenda and background.
I always get annoyed when I hear this is socialism or this is communism when it clearly isn't one or the other. Online and offline, a lot of dumb things are said and terms are being misused constantly with a clear intent to disqualify something with this kind of killer argument. However, when you argue like this, you devalue the terms. Let me explain with an example. If even the softest touch in soccer or American football is a foul, then what should we call real fouls? When one cries genocide in every war, how much does this devalue real genocides? And when one cries communism each time one encounters something that one doesn't like, what happens when large parts of the population suddenly say, okay, if that's communism, then I support communism. Seems like I am now a communist myself.
The sources that were used.
The version of the Principles of Communism that I own was published in 2023 by the Neuer Prometheus Verlag in Vienna. The book is fairly small and only has about 35 pages. So just like the Communist Manifesto, it was supposed to explain to interested citizens of the 19th century in a compact way what communism was all about. Engels chose a very interesting form to write this book. Instead of unloading tons of theory on the reader, his book consists of 25 questions about communism and his responses. In this episode, I will quote a couple of these questions and parts of the responses, and as usual, comment on them a bit. Quote page 5.
First question. What is communism? Answer: Communism is the doctrine of the conditions for the liberation of the proletariat. Second question. What is the proletariat? Answer: The proletariat is that class of society which derives its livelihood solely from the sale of its labor and not from the profit of any capital. The proletariat is the working class of the 19th century.
Engels starts with the most important explanations. According to his philosophy, the proletariat is the working class. From his point of view, the proletariat has to be liberated, and communism explains how this can be done. In question 4, Engels says that the proletariat was created by the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution was started in the late 18th century in England, with the invention and widespread use of the steam engine, which made machine-supported mass production possible. According to Engels, large factories pushed away smaller manufactories and ruined the craftsmen. After a process of elimination, only two classes remained. Quote from pages 8 and 9.
1. The class of large capitalists, who in all civilized countries already almost exclusively own everything one needs to live, and the raw materials and instruments, like machines and factories, necessary for the production of these things. This is the class of the bourgeoisie or the bourgeoisie. 2. The class of the completely propertyless, who are dependent on selling their labor to the bourgeoisie in order to obtain the means of subsistence necessary for their survival. This class is called the class of proletarians or the proletariat.
This is classic communist theory. The world is divided into exactly two groups, the capitalists that own things and the proletarians that own nothing. Every ideology tries to explain the world in a very simplified form from one point of view, ideally in an us versus them kind of way. Engels goes on by saying that labor is a product like any other, but the pay is so low that it only allows the worker to survive, nothing more. The proletarian only gets enough to prevent death, but not enough to provide him with a decent life that is actually worth living. Quote page 10.
Seventh question. How does the proletarian differ from the slave? Answer. The slave is sold once and for all. The proletarian must sell himself daily and hourly. The individual slave, the property of a master, has a secure existence, however miserable, simply through the interests of that master. The individual proletarian has no secure existence. This existence is secured only for the entire proletarian class. The slave frees himself by abolishing, among all private property relations, the relationship of slavery, and thereby becoming a proletarian himself. The proletarian can free himself only by abolishing private property altogether.
In countries with a history regarding slavery, like for example the US, sentences like these are bound to cause some turmoil. What is Engels actually trying to say here? According to his worldview, the existence of a slave is horrible but secure. He belongs to a master that exploits him but also provides for him. The fact that the slave is totally depending on this master is something that Engels doesn't mention at all. According to Engels, the main difference is that a proletarian is free but is not provided for at all. He depends on selling his labor in order to earn the minimum required to prevent death. If his labor is no longer required or he is no longer able to sell it, then his survival is in danger. The working class as a whole is important to society, but the individual worker is not. He is expendable. However, I doubt that this was different for individual slaves on cotton plantations in the south of the US. Quote page 13.
Tenth question. How does the proletarian differ from the manufactory worker? Answer. The manufactory worker of the 16th to 18th centuries almost everywhere still owned an instrument of production, his loom, the spinning wheels for his family, and a small field that he cultivated in his spare time. The proletarian lacks any of these. The manufactory worker almost always lives in the countryside and in more or less patriarchal conditions with his landlord or employer. The proletarian usually lives in a large city and has a purely monetary relationship with his employer.
This seems to be correct, and there is no question that the living and working conditions of industrial workers of the 19th century were among the worst that large portions of society ever had to endure. That being said, I doubt that manufactory workers of the previous centuries had a significantly better life. Maybe living conditions were better, but working in a manufactory and on the self-owned land afterwards, that is quite tough. Engels then continues by mentioning more things that happened because of the Industrial Revolution. He is partially correct, however he clearly shows a lack of historical knowledge and a rather Eurocentric worldview. Quote pages 13 and further.
Thus, countries that have made no progress for thousands of years, such as India, have been thoroughly revolutionized, and even China is now moving toward a revolution. In this way, large-scale industry has brought all the peoples of the earth into contact with one another.
After insulting the great nations of India and China in passing, Engels determines that industrialization has caused globalization. He is correct in saying that the industrialization brought power and influence to the bourgeoisie and that the old aristocratic leadership lost power. At some point, this had political consequences, for instance, the creation of representative democracy, in which only rich people could vote, or in which the vote of rich people had much more weight than the vote of poor people. One example for that is the three-class electoral law in Prussia. That was created only in 1849, but it was based on an older idea from France, which Engels is probably referring to here. Engels then determines that the proletariat develops together with the bourgeoisie. So if there is more bourgeoisie, then there's also more proletariat, because the capitalists need workers. Both classes are connected by fate. Another consequence of the Industrial Revolution is the cycle of economic crisis that is part of capitalism. market cycles, sometimes also referred to as pig cycles in German, of surplus and shortage, have dramatic effects on workers in all nations that have no social security nets. And in the 19th century, there wasn't much social security. Engels is correct in stating that under such conditions, workers live in a constant state of insecurity and are regularly confronted with unemployment, homelessness, poverty, and starvation. The way out of this was the introduction of social security systems. In Germany, Chancellor Otto von Bismarck introduced the social insurances in the 1880s that still exist today: health insurance, accident insurance, and pension insurance. In 1927, the Weimar Republic added unemployment insurance to that. After reunification, Germany added the nursing care insurance in 1995. However, Engels had other ideas, like abolishing private property and the nationalization of all property of the bourgeoisie. Now here comes a key question, quote page 21.
16th question. Will the abolition of private property be possible by peaceful means?
And the answer is no. According to Engels, this would be nice, but since proletarians are oppressed in all countries, they are forced to work towards revolution, and revolutions are rarely peaceful. Engels makes it clear that revolution won't fix all problems at once, but that they can only be solved step by step. The nationalization of factories will take several steps. Countries that are still mostly agrarian in nature, like Germany and France, which still were very agrarian in 1847, still have too many farmers and not enough workers to easily implement the dictatorship of the proletariat. Engels stresses that this means that representative democracy has to be implemented first as an intermediary step. However, the communists must implement the following 12 measures in this new society, and we know some of them already from episode 9. 1. Introduction of high taxes to limit private property. Modification of inheritance rules so that inheritance can only be passed down through the direct line. 2. Gradual nationalization of industry and transportation. 3. Confiscation of property from enemies and immigrants. 4. Reorganization of factory labor. 5. Compulsory labor for all until the abolition of private property. 6. Centralization of the monetary and banking systems. 7. Expansion of industry and agriculture. 8. Free education of children by the state, not by families. 9. Construction of communal housing projects for workers. 10. Destruction of all unhealthy and poor residential areas. 11. Equal inheritance rights for legitimate and illegitimate children. 12. Concentration of transportation in the hands of the state. With these 12 measures, Engels describes a massive encroachment on personal liberties and economic freedom of people, especially the compulsory labor for everyone, the fact that the state, not the families, will educate children, and the relocation of workers into communal housing signify a massive violation of personal freedom. And Engels doesn't mention, either deliberately or not, the fact that the concentration of industry, money, banking, and transport system in the hands of the top of the state creates an amount of power that is similar to that of absolute monarchs. He doesn't explain who is supposed to administer all these nationalized institutions. From today's point of view, we know that the top of the Communist Party will do this, with all the negative consequences that follow that decision. In question 19, Engels makes it clear that this revolution cannot happen in just one country, but that it has to happen in all capitalist countries because of the globalization that capitalism has caused. With that, Engels lays the foundation of the internationalism of communism in the 20th century, which created organizations like the Socialist International. Engels makes the guess that communism will be easiest to implement in England and the most difficult in Germany. The consequences of the abolishment of personal property are described in bright colors. The end of the worst sides of the industrialization, especially the living conditions, a wave of progress for society, industry, and agriculture, an end of the shortage of everyday goods. On page 28, there is a very remarkable part that I wanted to quote because of communist developments in Cambodia and China.
The division of labor, already undermined by machines, which makes one a farmer, another a shoemaker, a third a factory worker, and a fourth a stock market speculator, will thus disappear entirely. Education will enable young people to quickly pass through the entire system of production. It will enable them to move successfully from one branch of production to another, as the needs of society or their own inclinations prompt them to do so. It will thus deprive them of the one-sided character that the present division of labor imposes on each individual.
Now you can interpret this section in two ways. The first harmless and positive one, which in my opinion is incorrect, is to interpret this as the implementation of freedom of choice regarding your job. There's nothing wrong with having freedom of choice regarding your work, and while this may have existed in a theoretical form in the 19th century, it certainly didn't exist in practice all the time. However, Engels is not talking about that. He claims that in a communist system, everyone can learn and master every kind of job simultaneously. And everyone that ever worked in a job will know that there is a massive difference between doing a job and mastering a job. Training and specialization are not inventions of management or something new. In the 19th century, people also needed to be trained and to gather experience. Unfortunately, this communist thesis was brutally implemented in some cases. The killing fields in Cambodia and the Cultural Revolution in China come to mind. Due to brutal re-education, 2 million people died in Cambodia, out of a population of 8 million. And during the Cultural Revolution in China, hordes of farmers suddenly had to start producing steel, while young people from the cities moved to the countryside. This caused both a collapse within the industry as well as in agriculture. This, combined with the political turmoil of the time, caused the death of a lot of people. Estimates range from several hundred thousand to 20 million. Unfortunately for him, Engels gives me a hint on page 29 that my interpretation of this section is correct.
It follows from this that the contrast between town and country will also disappear. The operation of agriculture and industry by the same people is, for purely material reasons, a necessary condition of communist association.
In questions 21, 22, and 23, Engels talks about the effects of communism on family, nation, and religion. Basically, communism will make all of these things obsolete. Families will be broken up, the relationship man-woman will be a purely private thing, and children will be brought up by the state. Nations are supposed to mix and stop existing, and religions will become a thing of the past. In question 24, Engels explains the difference between communists and socialists. He differentiates between three types of socialists. He accuses one group of socialists to idealize the past. He claims they are trying to restore the feudal era. He accuses a second group of wanting to keep the current order of society and that they just want to fix the worst mistakes of capitalism. And he accuses the third group of wanting to implement democratic socialism without making the final step towards communism. These last two groups are probably the social democrats and the socialists of the time. So Engels positions himself at the radical left end of the spectrum of leftist movements of the time. In the last question, Engels explains how he imagines future relations between the Communist Party and other political parties to be. Regarding England, France, and Belgium, which are already under bourgeois control at the time, he sees few areas of common ground with the democratic parties there. Regarding the US, he says the communists should try to work with a party that is more on the left. And regarding Germany, where at the time there was still an absolute monarchy, he says that the communists should work with the bourgeois parties, because only when the bourgeoisie is ruling, the right conditions for a communist revolution can develop. And this marks the end of this small booklet.
A few finishing words.
Marx and Engels were great when it came to analysis. They accurately described the situation of the workers within the society of the 19th century. However, they didn't know what should come next. This is how the former Bundeschancellor of Germany, Helmut Schmidt, once described this. Engels' ideas regarding a communist society and how to get there were very vague, and his promises were overloaded. Absolute power for the party and its top functionaries that isn't mentioned once. Instead, from the get-go, the international character and the willingness to use violence is stated very clearly. Socialist groups that were against violent revolutions and instead tried to improve the living conditions of the workers within the framework of the existing societies were ridiculed and attacked. This ultimately caused the split between communists and social democrats, which, especially in Germany, caused massive problems and had dramatic consequences. During the Revolution of 1918, the Civil War of 1919, and the years of the Weimar Republic. At least Engels used a clear language and was able to keep things brief. In a future episode, I will discuss a book he wrote a couple of decades later.
Thank you. This was History Lost in Time.